open jurisdiction. Dan hesitated a moment before replying. Then he said, "You're telling me that the Russians could lean on the Venezuelan government to force us to let them in here." "That's what I'm telling you." "Yeah, Hernandez would roll out a fucking red carpet for them," Dan muttered. "They're going to get in here one way or the other," Weston said softly. "That doesn't mean I have to like it." "You don't have to be anywhere near here," the lawyer said. "You can be back at..." "Hey!" Weston's knees went rubbery and his eyes rolled up into his head. Dan grabbed him as he collapsed, held him up by his shoulders. The others rushed to them. "Too much sun," Dan realized. "Get him to the elevator, quick. Bring some water." They half-carried, half-dragged the lawyer to the shade of the elevator cab and lowered him gently to the scuffed tile floor. One of the women handed Dan a plastic cup full of tepid water. He held it to Weston's lips. Someone else pressed a paper towel soaked in water across his balding, freckled dome. "He'll be okay. Gonna have a beaut of a sunburn, though. He's not used to being outside. Better get him a salt pill." Weston opened his eyes. "What? How did..." Dan held the water to lips. "Shut up and drink this. For Christ's sakes, if you want me to let the Russians in here, you just had to ask me to do it, not pull this dying swan routine on me." The lawyer sipped at the water, then said weakly, "All in a day's work, boss." Malik brought his own little entourage with him, of course. Dan watched from the second-story window of the launch facility director's office as three black limousines, each bearing little red Russian flags on their front fenders, rolled up to the visitor's parking area. Dan counted an even dozen men entering the reception building. Malik was easy to spot. Not only was he taller and blonder than the others, he was the only one wearing a decent suit, a very modish, light, mocha-colored outfit of Italian silk. "Looks like a goddamned movie star," Dan grumbled to himself. The other Russians looked like extras, heavies. Dan personally led the tour, much to Malik's apparent delight. The Russian smiled and laughed his way through the afternoon, charming the women he met as well as the men. Dan smiled back, even told a few jokes along the way, but in his mind he thought he could hear the constant click of miniature cameras and the hum of tape recorders secreted on the bodies of the Russian visitors. It was hard to dislike Malik, though. The man seemed outgoing, friendly, and genuinely impressed with the launching facilities. "Marvelous, marvelous," he kept saying. Dan responded, "Your base at Curatum is much bigger." "Yes, but not as modern. These new boosters. How many tons did you say they lift?" They were standing on the floor of the mammoth vertical assembly tower where the heavy lift boosters were checked out before being trundled out to their launching pads. Two of the boosters, rising as tall and broad as sequoias, loomed up before them. Far above, a welder was showering sparks. He was so high overhead that the flashes from his torch looked like meteors streaking across the sky. 300 tons to low orbit," Dan replied. His voice echoed in the metal-walled building. 300 tons," Malik repeated. He seemed impressed.
"Is that metric tons?" one of the other Russians asked.
"Metric tons, right," said Dan. He imagined he heard the whirring of a tape recorder coming from the man's suit jacket.
"And you disassemble these boosters once they reach orbit?" Malik probed.
"Right. We only use these big dumb boosters to lift very heavy loads. Complete machine assemblies, for example, or a new smelting system. If we tried to put that heavy stuff up with the shuttles, it would take a dozen flights. Old Dumbo here can lift it in one shot."
Malik grinned at him. "And then Dumbo is broken apart after it has done its job."
Nodding, Dan explained, "The booster can't fly back to Earth like a shuttle can. It's not reusable. So we break it up and use the metal as structural material for housing the equipment the booster lifted. We send the rocket engines back on a shuttle. They're too expensive to throw away."
"Very ingenious," Malik said.
"You knew we were doing that," said Dan.
"Yes, I have read the reports about it, but still it is very good to see it with one's own eyes."
Finally, the little group reached the meteorology tower, and Dan took them up to the top. "From here you can see everything," he said, his outstretched arm sweeping out the view. Malik turned slowly in a full circle, squinting against the brutal afternoon sun. The other Russians looked distinctly uncomfortable, even a little fearful. "Maybe they'll pass out like Pete did," Dan hoped. "Maybe they'll all get sunstroke and die."
A tropical paradise, Malik said. I envy you. It is pretty, Dan agreed. The Caribbean glittered alluringly under a sky of brilliant blue. Stately cumulus clouds towered like the turrets of some giant's castle, row after row sailing slowly across the afternoon. The sun was a molten, glowing eye blazing down at them. Turning to take in the panorama, Dan saw the lush green mountains that stood between the coast and the teeming city of Caracas. They hid the city and the ugly sprawl of squatter shacks that huddled around it. The old airport lay across the narrow channel from the man-made island where they stood. Its long concrete runways were used only for space shuttle flights now. A massive double-decked shuttle was trundling slowly down to the end of the runway as they watched, the roaring whine of its jet engines no more than a thin keening at this distance. Riding atop the swept-wing lifter was the stubby, fat orbiter with its delta-shaped wings and big rocket nozzles poking out from under its rakish tail fin. The double-decked craft hesitated at the end of the long runway for a moment, seemed to gather itself, then lumbered down the 2-mile-long concrete strip, gathering speed, its engines thundering with undeniable power as it lifted its nose off the runway, and then raised itself and its piggyback orbiter off the ground and arrowed up into the blue. Dan glanced at his watch. The lifter will be back in half an hour, and there'll be an orbiter landing in about an hour if you want to go over to the field and watch it come in. What will it be carrying? Malik asked. Frowning slightly, Dan pecked at the tiny keys on his wristwatch. He held it to his ear so that he could hear the information he had asked for, then repeated, "Mixed cargo of pharmaceuticals, high-strength alloys, and electronics components, mostly gallium arsenide microchips, I suppose." The Russians glanced uneasily at each other and began to mutter in their own language. "That's La Guaira over there," Dan pointed toward the port. A tourist cruise ship was in the harbor, its red funnel bearing the hammer and sickle insignia. It was impossible to make out the cable car tramway that led up into the mist-shrouded mountains and then down the other side into Caracas, but Dan knew it would be packed with Russians and Eastern Europeans today. Malik was smiling like a video star. "You picked a perfect location for your operation, a perfect location." "Where else could I go?" Dan fumed silently, "after you forced America to give up space operations." Aloud, he said merely, "It's near the equator. That gives us some advantage from the Earth's spin." "And the Venezuelan government is very cooperative," the Russian said. Dan sensed a trap ahead. "This entire operation," he answered slowly, "belongs to the Venezuelan government, to the people of Venezuela, since this country is a democracy. Astro Manufacturing Corporation operates this facility under contract to the government. This is not a privately owned facility. Otherwise," he added silently, "you would never have gotten past the front gate without a squad of tanks." "Yes, of course," Malik agreed easily, still grinning. "But you managed to make a profit from all this, even though it belongs properly to the people of Venezuela." "I managed to eke out a living," Dan replied, smiling back at him. "And so do the people of this country. This space manufacturing operation accounts for as much of Venezuela's gross national product as her oil exports, and twice as much as her agricultural exports." "But how much profit do you make?" Malik asked, his smile looking slightly sardonic now. "As much as the government allows." "And how much is that?" "Ask Señor Hernández. He has the figures." Malik would not be deterred. "Enough to feed the poor people living in those miserable hovels outside the city? Would you say that your profits could help to feed the poor rather than making a very rich man even richer?" "This operation makes jobs for thousands of engineers and tax accountants and butchers, bakers, telescope makers." Dan found himself enjoying the challenge of argument. "Cooks, babysitters, auto mechanics, salespeople of all kinds, gardeners, truck drivers, you name it. We bring money into this country, and each bolivar that space operations produces gets spent 8 or 10 times over within the country's internal economy. That's a considerable multiplier, and it's fed more Venezuelans than all the damned welfare programs the government's ever funded." Malik laughed derisively. "And yet there are still many hungry people while you live in luxury." Dan started to reply, but held himself in check for a moment. He saw something in Malik's eyes, something crafty and dangerous. The other Russians were watching the two of them, even those who claimed they could not understand English.